This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we get a movie review from Matt O'Lean. We are going to start today doing that thing where we skip right over Thanksgiving and think about Christmas. It is time to get into that Christmas holiday spirit. Performances are a big part of the holiday season, especially after a COVID pause. And they are nice and multi-sensory. There's sight and sound and feeling and so much more. Paul Johnson is the longtime muralist whose backdrop sets the stage for the Concordia Christmas Concert. This year's performances are December 3rd, 4th, and 5th. And the theme is, "And Glory Shone Around." The theme is picked by the conductor, Dr. Michael Colleton, and I spoke with Johnson about how the Christmas concert is very much a team effort and how long it takes to get this mural completed.
Many, many hours, because you have to find a central, he gives you the theme, but you've got to try to tie it all together. So it's, in essence, the same story, but trying to change it every year, which is not an easy thing to do on Finding. This is my 13th year, and I'm going, oh, wait a minute, I've done that already.
Right. What more is there to the story of the birth of Christ?
Right,
like,
exactly.
What have we not covered yet?
Exactly. So it's always trying to find different angles, different, and it might be Mary, it might be emphasis on this, or in this case, Michael said, tons of angels. We need tons of angels. Or angels all over the place is what he said. And that helps define that. But then you're reading all the material and highlighting. So I do a lot of cross-referencing. I use a thesaurus. Mm-hmm. It helps me a lot to certain things that I'm highlighting. And then it's drawn, and then once they, usually by towards the end of, middle to end of July, I'm sending scans of my drawing to them. And they'll make some suggestions, flip this, do that, no, I don't like this, make some adjustments, and then when I get there, okay, then I trace it, scan it, and then I trace it in Adobe Illustrator. And so that's what you'll see on the screen.
Yeah, I looked at your screen, and I mean this with no offense at all, but it looks like one of those ending shots in a crime thriller where they finally have found who the serial killer is, because there's scraps everywhere, and then there's, you know, lines drawn to here, and we connect this, and then that, and then there's this, and then there's some color.
It's a vector program. So the reason why I work in Illustrator is it's vector-based. It's not a raster file, so I'm not working with the pixels you would in Photoshop, for instance. Mm. It's all mathematical vectors or little segments, and so I can transform it. I can go from a really small file, I think it's only 10 or 13 inches long, and they'll enlarge it to 296 feet. So everything's proportional. So a pike equals a foot, for instance. Then I don't have to, take out terabytes of space to do it in Photoshop. So it's all vector based, and I've been teaching Illustrator at the college where I teach this is my 20th year, so I guess for 20 years I've been teaching the software, and I've probably worked on it professionally that time and another 10 years before that. So every year it challenges. I mean, you want to do certain things, and you're trying to find new ways of doing it.
The process of, I mean, I'm thinking when you can look at a paint sample on a 2x2-inch square and it looks great, and then you paint your wall and you're like, this is way too much color.
Right.
So how do you go through this process of knowing something that looks good at less than an inch big is going to look great at a foot?
Well, I tell you, it's a dynamic, changing thing, but I've said this many times and I'm not exaggerating. When I start it, I start with prayer. I really do. Mm. And when it's done, I look back on it and go, I have no idea how that happened. I really don't.
You're the vessel.
Because I really, there's so many pieces that have to fit and have to work in it. And but some of the things, I'll look at just color principles, complements. If I've got a yellow, I'm going to look at a purple to complement it. So I'm using some really basic color foundational principles. triads, and you know, I'm looking at color that way. And I like to spread it around so it's not all blue or all purple, but there's a nice mixture, because Brian Duncan can make any color change by his lights. So whatever I put up there, he can change. And so I know whatever I do, he's going to manipulate to the nth degree. And so that's pretty spectacular, and that's what really makes this mural unique versus painted, isn't that it's a it's an RGB file, so it's like printing something off your laser printer. And in essence, it is. It's just a 4 foot by how many feet you need.
laser. You know, the huge.
Yeah, so it's huge, and it's wall output on wallpaper.
How long does it take just to print?
I'm sure up to 3 weeks and maybe four if they take their time, you know. But they're printing pretty close to around the clock. So.
Wow.
So it's going through, and then they check it, adjust it. We go through many proofs to make sure it's correct. So, yeah, it's kind of a monster. I love doing it. It's a real passion of mine. I hope every year I hope that we're able to do it again. But it is certainly a worry from the day I hand it to the vendor, and that's Short Printer in West Fargo. And they have the printers that are able to do this. And I hand it to them, and by the time I get it up on and all the contractors here build this thing, I'm like a expectant father, you know. I'm just nervous as can be. Because if things don't line up, and we've had some real... you know, surprises over the years doing something like this. Well, if there's so many technical things, maybe the a plotter or something went wrong halfway through, and so all the lines are missing or something, and then but they're really phenomenal about checking it. I think they check every foot of it while it's coming out.
Okay, so. You've never had like Jesus come out with dreadlocks or something?
No, nothing like that. if he's in dreadlocks, I put him there. But it's kind of a stressful time for sure, because anything could go wrong, and you know, everything builds towards that. You know, the choir and lighting and the stage and the Brian's waiting for it. It's just a domino effect. So everything's got to work together, and if it goes haywire on us, we only have so many hours to fix it.
Yeah.
So we have Wednesday, the day before Thanksgiving, as a fluff day. I think people are working around here, but if I needed to, I could use that day if there was something that went wrong. I've been known to take these big ladders that are, I mean, some of these panels are, you know, they're 24 feet high.
Yeah.
And if there's something off, you know, my wife doesn't like to hear this, but I'll take a ladder and I'll prop it up there, and I'm up there taking a little can of spray adhesive and adjusting the lines, so make sure everything crosses over.
Do you have
the
good
panels.
Health insurance?
Right. I don't think Concordia likes it when I'm doing that, but I try to sneak in. And,
you're not
and
getting hazard pay here.
No. Try to do that, but anyway.
Well, and then this is the backdrop for the concert, but also this ends up on mugs, and this is like this is a thing people collect.
Yeah, I don't know why they do that, but they do. I thought my mother was the only one that collected stuff like that. But and that's kind of why David Hetland, God bless him, he did it for I don't know how many years, 20 plus years. He did it all paint by number, and so he would draw it like this, and then they had a much smaller or somewhat smaller mural, and then he would paint by number. He'd go in and draw it on these big sheets of muslin, and then they would go in and paint. So he would have lots of volunteers that would come in, but he would paint pretty much right up to the day. I'm not quite sure. They worked around the clock. The man worked tireless. And then I came along when he passed away, and they looking for a new muralist. I said, I can't do it like David did. I don't have the time. I teach full-time in Alexandria. There's no way I can do this and to devote that kind of time that David did.
It's an hour and a half drive just to come
here.
Yeah,
and I've commuted for 20 years to Alexandria from Pelican Rapids. So, I mean, I've done this. But and it's just one of those things where I can't do this. And I said, why don't you go digital? Because what's great about it is we can get the file done. You can use it for all kinds of promotional we didn't know at the time what kind of lighting would change versus just traditional paint, because it's it's RGB files. It's like looking at your monitor when they throw the lights on. So the colors are most magnificent colors I've ever seen when he puts lights on it. It's just unreal. And I don't believe Dave was able to get those kind of levels because it was paint. And this is just a different, and the gradients, Dave was never able to do gradients. And I learned so much from him, and that's still in each mural, you know, the technique, the outline, and so forth.
Well, you get kind of the analog and digital, like the best of both worlds coming together, it sounds like.
And I know that he was just starting to look digitally before he passed away. He was just blown away with what it could do.
Yeah.
And who knows what would have happened. I can't believe he would have ever stopped doing it. It was just part of who he was as a liturgical artist, and I'm sure he'd still be doing it. I'm sure he would do it up until his last breath, and that's basically what he did.
What's a liturgical artist?
Well, I that's something I really would like to do. When I'm done teaching, I would just like to dedicate the rest of my life to murals and stained glass and brands for churches and signs and banners, you name it.
Yeah.
Pretty much.
There's a long history
everything.
In that. This goes back to a time before people could read. They were telling the story of Christianity through the stained glass windows.
When I was a little boy and I went to church with my parents in Pelican Rapids, and I remember sitting in the pew, and of course you always took the pencil that was there and you wrote on the... And I would just kind of listen to the stories, and I'd just do little drawings, even as a little boy. And I always felt that closeness to God and church and art as a visual representation of what's being spoken. And, of course, across the world, you know, go to Notre Dame or whatever, you're going to see incredible art to complement the mission. And so I'd like to, what I call a liturgical artist, I don't know if there's such a noun, but that's what I'd like to do. And in essence, that's what I am, because the field house turns into a big church for just a few days, but it's a massive holy place. And then it goes back to basketball.
Which we also worship in this country.
Yeah, right, exactly. Exactly. So,
well, I'm just curious. You spend months, you spend your emotional, physical, spiritual energy pouring into this, from drawing it and meetings and refining and taking it to the digital space, and then printing it and then adhering it to wallpaper and putting it onto these big structural panels that can support it. And then, like you said, it goes up for 3 days.
And then they put it down. It's torn down. It's torn down. So everything is thrown away.
Is that kind of like the concept of sand art, where it's meant to be appreciated in the
Time?
Well,
our very first couple murals, when I presented this to Concordia, we thought we could just staple these, and that I would redesign each segment, each five-panel segment, into individual things, and they could sell them or give them to local churches, and indeed we did. The problem was is that we had all these lights to start with. It was our first year on television, and we had twice the lights. So the next year we did it, and it was a disaster because all the panels would sag. We tried duct tape. We tried staples. We tried it all, and we finally said we only have one other option, and that's wallpaper. And so there went sharing the file.
Gotcha.
Concordia has the rights. They can share the digital files with anyone if they want. But my thought was to share these actual panels, and this church gets this 8, or this church gets this 10, or whatever, and now that's that we haven't been able to do because we need to light it. So now Brian, I think what he said, he could only light it up to 30% when we were stapling it. Now he can get it up to 100% lit, and so the colors are just, I remember he was just astounded when we were finally wallpapering. He said, "You can't believe we've reached this point."
Yeah.
So it's a unique thing. I don't think there's a lot of churches or schools or anything around the nation that are doing something this big.
And have been for 95 years now.
Yeah, well, they've never, you know, David, you know, I think the mural kept growing, but it's as big as it's, you know, we've got literally inches to spare from one end of the field house to the other.
So what's it feel like in your soul when you finally get to gaze upon the finished
product? I guess it's like, you know, as an artist, for me anyway, you know, I'm an illustrator, graphic designer, to be able to look at something that you've created and see other people enjoying it. Because quite honestly, I'm sick of it. At that point, I mean, I look at it and I just go, oh man, I wish I'd have changed that. I wish I'd have done this. So,
yeah, the bane of the creative.
Yeah, right. And you just, and parts of it, you go, oh yeah, that turned out, well, I wish I'd have, I don't ever want to see that again. And because you're just tired of working on it. I think every professional, you've worked on a story for so long and you're just like, I just want it to be done. Mm-hmm. And you get to that point.
Perfection is the enemy of
done,
right?
Absolutely. I know we're on radio, but you know, I was joking. I had a lot of hair before I started doing this, and now, you know, an eighth of an inch. So,
after just 13 short years.
Yeah, no. Just call that working in the creative field, period. But no, it's a pleasure and a joy to do it. And I think as an artist, you see this and you go, that isn't me that did that. It really isn't. People say, how do you do that? And I go, anybody could do this. You just pray to start with, and you've got faith in that it's going to turn out and it's going to be there.
Well, that's the part that's hard, the leaping.
Oh, yeah. Leaping is right. Because I'm kind of on my seat's edge because we have to inspect and wallpapering, and you just don't know what you're going to get. So it's one of those scary things. So I'm hoping by, you know, this time tomorrow the end will be in sight. So down to our last few panels.
How do you hope people will sort of walk through the mural with their eyes?
Well, there's a lot of things in there, and that this is probably the most complex mural I've ever done. I would say 95% of it is covered in imagery. It's just insane for me. I realized that after I started doing it. I'm going, why did I do this? This is just nuts. M.C. Escher really inspires me, what this man was able to do. And on the left side, you'll see more of that, where objects will fit into other objects. So there's a lot of solid imagery based on Michael's, what he wants in this is his concert. And then it just evolves. And every inch is really filled. And every year I go, what do you want to do differently this year? And they really like the stained glass, so it's always trying to make it look more stained glass, more. So I spend a lot of time just sitting in churches with stained glass and inspecting and measuring and seeing, okay, how did they do this, and try to make it look like that in a digital setting. But it's church, and I just hope they'll come back and they'll feel the the spirit of Christmas, and we're supposed to have it in our hearts all year round, and so hopefully this will inspire people to keep that, I guess. It's easier said than done, but I'm one of those few people that get to work on Christmas stuff for quite a few months. It is a real honor to be able to be Concordia's muralist each year, and I hope I can do it up until my last breath. So,
Paul, thank you so much for your time today.
It was a pleasure. It really was, and I encourage everybody to get out and enjoy Christmas again.
That was muralist Paul Johnson about the Concordia Christmas backdrop. Performances this year are December 3rd, 4th, and 5th, and tickets are available at Concordia College's website. Tom Ezern is next.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Basin Electric Power Cooperative, headquartered in Bismarck. A Touchstone Energy Cooperative, generating and delivering electricity to over 3 million consumers in 9 states, spanning from the Canadian to Mexican border.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and longtime listeners of Main Street will know that historian Tom Ezern loves telling the stories of this land. And sometimes those stories come in the form of song. Here he is with this week's Plainsfolk essay, Dim Narrow Trails.
Over the past couple of years, I've been engaged in a revival of balladry on the Great Plains. Returning to my roots as a folkie from way back in the 20th century, I've been revisiting the histories of folk songs once considered of unknown origin, documenting them, and singing them as a contribution to our regional literature. It is amazing how, with the advantage of digitization of documents, especially newspapers, it is possible to track traditional ballads to their very origins. There are complications, of course. For instance, I've gone into a rabbit hole of documentation on an old cowboy song known by many titles: The Cowboy's Dream, The Cowboy's Hymn, The Dim Narrow Trail, Roll On Little Doggies, and others. I find it, under the title The Cowboy's Dream, in a booklet, Cowboy Songs, published by the WPA Federal Writers Project in Nebraska in 1937. On examination, I determine the Nebraska writers have lifted the text of nine stanzas, plus a chorus, directly from John Lomax's classic compilation of 1910, Cowboy Songs and Other Frontier Ballads. Checking back to Lomax, he says explicitly, "Sung to the air of My Bonnie Lies Over the Ocean." The Nebraska authors, however, transcribe another melody for the verses, which goes something like this. "Last night as I lay on the prairie and looked at the stars in the sky, I wonder if ever a cowboy could drift to the sweet by and by. The road to that bright, happy region is a dim, narrow trail, so they say. But the broad road that leads to perdition is posted and blazed all the way." Now, scholars of balladry pretty much throw up their hands when they essay to fix the origins of this cowboy song, citing all manner of reminiscent accounts dating from the 1870s and 1880s. Now, on the other hand, I can now give you a fixed point of reference in the ballad's history, a text published in the New Mexican Review, 9th of March, 1893, under the title The Cowboy's Hymn. The publication notice says the song was written by Mr. John L. Zimmerman and set to music by Mr. Fred W. Joyce, both formerly of Las Vegas and Roswell, and is dedicated to Honorable Ernest Myers, representative of Bernalillo County in the last legislature. Major Myers was quite a historic character, a pioneer of the liquor industry in New Mexico Territory, adept at both business and fisticuffs. This is the sort of specificity of origin that might inspire confidence in a researcher, unless he has been inoculated to the tendency of folk authors to claim personal authorship of ballads that, in fact, they have simply appropriated and made their own through adaptation. Given the multiple, if sometimes dubious, accounts of previous circulation, I suspect this 1893 text is a matter of such appropriation, and so I cannot pin down a specific origin for the song. I can, however, conclude that the 1893 text is powerfully significant in the circulation and popularization of the ballad, for thereafter it appears in many iterations up and down the plains, although oddly nowhere I have seen in Dakota Territory. And the Cowboy's Hymn, or whatever you call it, is certainly a folk song, circulating and morphing as it travels the plains, as the multiple texts I have from across several states attest. I cut some slack to these folk authors and their claims, for as one of my collected texts confesses in New Testament fashion, "I wonder if ever a cowboy prepared for that great judgment day, who could say to the boss of the riders, I'm ready to be driven away."
Dr. Tom Usern is a distinguished professor of history at North Dakota State University. Still to come on Main Street, the magical Medora Christmas show goes on tour. But first, this news.
Good afternoon from the Prairie Public Newsroom. I'm Todd McDonald. The Great Plains Food Bank is doing whatever it takes to meet the needs of hungry people throughout the state this year. CEO Melissa Sobolik says just prior to the pandemic, about 1 in 9 people relied on emergency food assistance in North Dakota. After the onset of COVID, that increased to 1 in 6. To make matters worse, food donations plummeted. But Sobolik says the food bank remains committed to meeting the needs of hungry people.
So we really had to shift gears and we started purchasing truckloads of product. I mean, that's not our normal business model, but we have this commitment to feed people and we were going to do whatever we needed to do to get that food in. Now we're starting to see donations come up a little bit. However, we're still about 43% lower than where we were 2 years ago. And so the food product is just not out there. It's a supply issue. And so we are just doing whatever we can to purchase food, find good deals just to bring it in and get it to people.
Looking forward, Sobolik says the food bank is launching a new strategic plan to end hunger in the region. She says the plan will address many root cause issues to prevent people from ever needing the food bank services in the first place. A new report details how North Dakota students who identify as LGBTQ often struggle with the environment within their schools. Their advocates say the findings show the importance of doing more to protect these individuals and make them feel welcome. Through the Community Uplift Program, the North Dakota LGBTQ School Climate Report shows nearly 60% of these students say they've been bullied on school grounds, but only 13% of districts that respond require staff training on LGBTQ culture. Barry Nelson of the North Dakota Human Rights Coalition feels the approach is too broad in addressing harassing behavior.
It's fine to talk about it in generalities, but we know that it is particularly poignant within the LGBTQ population in the school.
The report's author notes only 1 in 6 young people who identify as queer will turn to an adult when feeling empty, sad, hopeless, or angry. And without meaningful infrastructure, that can prompt other issues, from missing school to experiencing homelessness and even suicide. The decision by the Grand Forks School Board to end the mask mandate policy for in-school learning creates a unique situation for students and staff on Grand Forks Air Force Base. The current Air Force policy is masking in all indoor facilities. 319th Reconnaissance Wing Commander Colonel Timothy Curry says if masks aren't required at Twining School, it would be the only building on the base that's optional. Colonel Curry says he told his commanders this week to expect to be wearing masks for at least the next 3 to 4 months. Around 311 K-8 students attend school on the Grand Forks Air Force Base. From the Prairie Public Newsroom, I'm Todd McDonald.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and it is time to get in the holiday spirit for the Magical Medora Christmas Tour. I have two guests joining me, Bill Sorensen and Amber Lee Rosen. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having us. It's great to be here.
Yeah, ditto.
I literally just flew in to the Bismarck Airport right now, and Bill picked me up and was like, we're going to the radio station. So here we are. This
and we're doing awesome. An interview, and you're going to, also, by the way, you're going to be in this show, right?
Oh, it's perfect. I'm so happy.
There's going to be more than 30 shows in more than 20 communities across North and South Dakota, Minnesota, and even a little bit into Montana, starting on Friday the 26th and going into Thursday the 23rd. So let's just start with keeping up the energy of performing on a schedule like that.
Well, it's tougher for me, the old guy, but as you probably can already tell, Amber Lee brings a lot of energy, and so does Chad Willow, our music director. There's a lot of energy that comes from these people, but we feed off. It's been unbelievably well received the years we've been doing this tour, and so we are very fortunate that we get a lot of energy from the crowd.
Yes, the crowd is incredible, and it's just an amazing amount of support that's coming from everyone and the cast and crew and everyone. It's just a great team of people.
You can find all the tour dates and purchase tickets at medora.com. And I'm curious from both of you here, and we can start with Amber Lee, as we talk about this time of year that can be deeply spiritual and moving, but then also it's festive and it's fun and it's light, and you have to go back and forth between songs that capture both of those emotions and probably a whole lot of other ones in between. How do you go through a performance like that?
Yeah, definitely. I think that this show is written really well in the sense that there's different sections of the show. So there's a part of the show that's very spiritual. And then there's, you know, some parts that make you laugh and you're just having a silly time. And then there's other parts that are, you know, we throw in the country twang. And then there's other parts that were pretty... We bluegrass it up a bit, and then there's other parts that were very, you know, more on the classical spectrum of things. So we give a little of everything, and we definitely keep the Christmas spiritual side in there as well, because that is a very important part of it.
Bill, as the more veteran performer.
That's a very kind way of saying that.
Just curious, your thoughts on going up and down, being with the crowd energy and keeping this up throughout the years even.
Yeah, well, you know, and what you just said is we try to do both those things in the show. We try to have a lot of fun and bring a lot of joy in the show, but we also recognize that it's a special time of year, and so we do have a great spiritual component to our show, so people can be aware of that. And our cast is just amazing this year, so that's where we get a lot of this energy. There's a young guy, in fact, Amber Lee hasn't had a chance to meet him yet, a young guy by the name of Jacoby, is actually from Minot, North Dakota, that's part of our cast, and he's going to be big time. I'll tell you right now.
Aww.
I'll tell you right now. I'm going to write it down. In fact, he auditioned for three other shows after he did the Medora musical this summer and got all three. And he's done with our Christmas tour, he's the lead, the non-costume character on Sesame Street Live that tours big arenas all over the country.
Fun.
Yeah. Very
oh
cool.
My gosh.
Very cool. Yeah. And so we've got a very talented cast of people that help us bring that energy and bring that spirit.
Well, Amberlee, let's talk about being on the road with a crew. You are performing with these people, but then you also sort of have to live with them during this time period. And obviously, it's not necessarily people that you grow up with, but the camaraderie and the challenges of being on a high energy, very busy tour.
Yeah, you just have to make sure to listen to yourself, and you know, when you need to take a little time to just breathe, you do it, you know, and then also being a team player is just so important, you know, enjoying the other people that you're with and then taking time for yourself if you need that kind of thing. So it's really, I love touring, but I will say, you know, it can be pretty tough on the body. So you just have to have that balance.
Yeah. I want to have our listeners experience a little bit of what you are bringing to the performance, Amberlee, because you have a particular instrument. Set us up with what you love about your fiddle and then what you're going to play for us.
All right. Well, I pretty much love everything about my fiddle, violin, whatever you want to call it. It currently has strings on it, but soon after it'll have some strings. So I'm going to start with something a little bit more spiritual, classical, and then I'm going to go into a little fiddle ditty.
Okay.
So here we go. Thank you.
In just a couple minutes, you brought us to two very different places.
Indeed, indeed. Yeah, so I started with some Oh Holy Night, and then I went into some Orange Blossom Special.
And she did that. I said 2 minutes ago as we were walking in here, I said, why don't you bring your violin with you? Maybe we'll play some. So she,
oh, she's one of those.
She's one of those people that she can do anything at the drop of a hat. So.
It's very, very fun. And so you'll hear both of those songs.
Yeah,
I think I heard a little foot stomping, right as that second song kicked in,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I was stomping pretty hard, and I realized, you know what? This is radio. I better stop stomping so hard.
No, it's great. That's what people go to live performances for.
Yeah.
Speaking of live performances, Bill Medora, the energy of being on stage and doing this year in and year out and something that you love and you and the audience feed off one another, and then you throw in something like a pandemic.
Yeah. Whatever our new normal is, right?
Yeah.
You know, we didn't get to tour last year. We did our show in Medora, and it just was not the same. Mm. You know, just not the same. So we're so thankful and grateful that we get to go out on the road again, and I think people are anxious to safely be gathering again. And so, I guess we'll all are cautious, but we're all ready to celebrate.
Hmm. We're visiting today with Bill Sorensen and Amberlee Rosen of the Magical Medora Christmas Tour. They are coming to a town near you between November 26th and December 23rd. You can find the whole tour and get tickets at medora.com. Amberlee, when did you first pick up the fiddle? And what is the difference between a fiddle and a violin anyway?
All right. So, yeah, I first started playing violin when I was 3.5 years old. And that was actually when I was living in Mendocino, California. And then I continued my studies when I was 4 when we moved to Oregon, Eugene, Oregon. And I was inspired because my older sister just out of nowhere decided that she wanted to play. Mm. And I have a great older sister, and I always loved what she loved and wanted to do what she did. So and now we both play professionally. I'm more on the fiddle side and she's more on the classical side. But the difference between a violin and a fiddle is, as I said before, a violin has strings and a fiddle has strings, but really there's no difference. It's just the way you play it.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're playing a fast fiddle tune and you add this thing called vibrato to it, which is when you are kind of pulsating your hand, your violin hand, back and forth, you don't get a fiddly sound. And same with like classical music. If you slide into things like in a fiddly way, it just doesn't sound classical. So like, sorry, I put down my fiddle, but let me give you a little clue. So here's Turkey in the Straw. Now classical.
It hardly seems like the same song.
That's what I'm saying. Like, it's, you know, and then you can make it sound really kind of sad. And all I did was make it minor.
Wow.
You know, so like you just, I mean, it's amazing what you can do with music. So really, it's just the way you play it. You know,
yeah.
I added some vibrato when I was doing the classical stuff, and I take it away when I'm doing the fiddle stuff.
Do you feel like you understand a song differently if you're playing it in that sort of classical or with the vibrato or making it sad?
You know, I think it's just a different interpretation.
Hmm. Bill, how does a performance like this change depending on the venue? You know, sometimes you're on college campuses, sometimes you're in a small community theater, sometimes you're in auditoriums.
Yeah, you wouldn't believe the difference that we have between, you know, huge auditoriums at Sioux Falls and the Chester Fritz and Grand Forks and to a couple school gymnasiums, other places. It's so fun to do. We always do some small towns. And it is so much fun to do those. I tell a lot of stories about going to Henning, Minnesota, which was one of our favorite stops, and how enjoyable that has been. But it's hard to even make the set fit in some places.
I feel like they, you know, when you go to those small towns, they're just so appreciative, like because you've come close to, you know, it's just a small town. But the big crowds are really, really appreciative, too. You know, the bigger towns are, too.
Yeah.
It's just I love that audience rapport between the performers and the audience. It's just a really lovely kind of friendship, you know.
The Magical Medora Christmas Tour kicks off Friday the 26th and goes across more than 20 communities, putting on 31 shows until Thursday, December 23rd. You can get your tickets and find out the tour schedule at medora.com. Amber Lee Rosen and Bill Sorensen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thanks so much
for having us. Yeah, it was great.
It was a lot of fun.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by Bill Dean, Realtor with Alliance Real Estate of Bismarck, serving the Bismarck, Mandan, and Minot areas from homes and ranches to rental properties. More information at BillDeanHomes.com.
When you hear the fanfare, that means it's time to go off to the movies with Matt Olien, something maybe quite a few people will be doing over the long holiday weekend. Matt, you have gone to see Belfast. This is Kenneth Branagh's childhood. Did I get that name right?
Yeah, okay. It is his childhood. It's autobiographical, set in 1969 Northern Ireland. Some people may not realize Kenneth Branagh is Irish. I think people assume he's English because of, you know, playing Henry V, playing Laurence Olivier in My Week with Marilyn, famous Englishman.
They're pretty English.
But he is Irish, and he grew up in Belfast, and this is shot in black and white, lovingly recreated his childhood. It's an interesting movie, and I loved it because it's one part childhood memory with kind of kids playing with each other and fun childhood growing up. His family is Protestant. Of course, these are the times when the Protestant Catholic thing was really bad. English troops were sent in.
It was violent.
It was horrible. It's this period of time called the Troubles where a lot of people left Ireland because there was unemployment was high. There was violence. It was awful. So the film is really part, you know, him playing with other kids and being obsessed with movies. He goes to Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. He sees Raquel Welch in 1 Million Years B.C. He watches High Noon, John Wayne movies. So you can see the forming of Kenneth Branagh as the movie star director. But there's trouble. His parents are having financial trouble. His dad works in England part-time and then comes back. So it's partly whimsical childhood memory and part violence. We get the violence as well. We see the bombings. Branagh shoots it in black and white. The bombings are scary when they happen because you don't see them coming in the scene. So really, really wonderful movie, Oscar contender. It feels like Roma, the film that came out in 2018, directed by Alfonso Cuarón, which was about his upbringing in Mexico. The difference is, as I said at the time of Roma, it feels like you're looking through a family album with Cuarón, but there's no context. You can't feel anything. Nothing interesting happens. I thought the film was very overrated. In this sense, you get the feeling. It's lovingly put together. You feel for his grandparents, played by Ciarán Hinds and Judi Dench. You feel for his parents, played by Jamie Dornan and Katrina Bolf. The young boy who plays Kenneth Branagh is Jude Hill. He's wonderful in this film. So he makes that connection that you feel for this family. You care about this family, just like we cared about the family in Minari, the film last year about the Korean immigrant family in Arkansas. So that's why the film works. It works because we feel for the family. We feel for their struggle. What are they going to do? Are they going to stay in Ireland? Are they going to go somewhere in the Commonwealth to live, to give the boys a better life? What are they going to do? And it's fascinating how it's put together. It's a short movie. The performances are great. Katrina Balf is really good as Kenneth Branagh's mother. She really has the performance of the movie, along with Ciarán Hinds as his grandfather. There's some supporting actor buzz for that. He's probably not the right age to play Judi Dench's husband. He's about 19 years younger. Judi Dench is really the only English actress or actor in the movie. Everyone else was born in Ireland, so he did a really good job casting. The film, at times, Ashley, gets right up to the line of sticky sentimentality, which sometimes remembrance films do, but it never quite gets over that line. Mm-hmm. He plays it just perfectly where it doesn't become some kind of, you know, after-school special Disney movie.
Everything was perfect in the 50s and 60s, except for Cold War drills.
Right. Belfast 1969. Everything was great.
Yeah, right.
He doesn't quite get up to that line, but he almost does in a few spots.
Huh.
But overall, I loved it. I think people are going to like this movie. The only way you won't feel something is if your heart is very hard in this movie. It's very poignant in spots.
Well, how about this young boy who is the lead actor? I think Jude was the name.
Jude Hill.
Yeah, you said he was great. But, you know, in a movie like this, when an inexperienced actor has the lead, it's such a risk. It's such a gamble on the part of the filmmaker.
It's all in the casting. And Kenneth Branagh found this boy. He's great. He carries the movie. But I think what helps too, Ashley, is he casts the boy opposite really fine actors. These are name actors. Ciarán Hinds. If you don't know the name, you know the face. Judi Dench. Everyone knows who Judi Dench is. Jamie Dornan, Katrina Balf as the parents are really wonderful as well. Jamie Dornan kind of looks like a young Kenneth Branagh too. So you kind of get that sense of, oh, this guy could play Kenneth Branagh's dad. But he's great. Jude Hill gives a wonderful performance, and he's supported by a good director, which Branagh is. I mean, his Henry V is one of the great Shakespearean films ever directed that he starred in, of course, back in 1989. So he gets a great performance out of this child. And when you can get a great performance out of a child, it really helps a movie. And as you said, Ashley, when things go sideways and a child is not up to snuff as an actor, like in the Clint Eastwood movie Cry Macho, the juvenile actor opposite him was so bad in that movie that you felt sorry for the kid. Not the case with Belfast.
What are you excited to go see over Thanksgiving? A lot of movies start to open around the holidays.
Well, I hope Power of the Dog gets close to around where I live. That's the Jane Campion movie with Kirsten Dunst and Benedict Cumberbatch that's getting a lot of Oscar buzz.
I read
it's a Western.
Karen's website.
House of Gucci, Ridley Scott, his second directed movie of the year. He did The Last Duel, which I liked, but nobody saw. House of Gucci, you know, Lady Gaga, Adam Driver, Al Pacino, Jeremy Irons, huge cast. We're hearing kind of mixed reviews on it right away, but I want to see that. And then King Richard with Will Smith as the father of Venus and Serena Williams. He's kind of the kingmaker of those kids as they became superstar tennis players, and there's some Oscar buzz for Will Smith.
All right.
So I'll try to get to one of those for sure next week.
All right. So Oscar trivia, you mentioned that Dame Judi Dench is in this film. She has been nominated multiple times. She's won once. Give us as many as you know.
She won for Shakespeare in Love in 1998.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And then many other nominations. Mrs. Brown, 1997.
Mm-hmm.
Iris, 2001.
Mm-hmm.
Chocolat, 2000.
Mm-hmm.
Notes on a Scandal, 2006.
Mm-hmm.
Mrs. Henderson Presents.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the year is escaping me, though.
05.
05. And there's one more. Philomena, 2013.
All right. Someday I just got to go inside that brain.
No, you don't want to.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by United Way of Cass Clay, bringing our community together.
lifting families out of poverty, and creating a better tomorrow for all of us. When we believe united, we succeed united. Learn more at UnitedWayCassClay.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for November 24th. On this date in 1911, William Gilbreth, Commissioner of Agriculture in North Dakota, was busy. In fact, the Bismarck Tribune called him about the busiest official at the State House for the past 6 months, and no small wonder. He had been busy all those months working on the state's first industrial exposition, which ran from September 26th to October 14th. The event had showcased resources and exhibits from all across the state, drawing enormous crowds. The Fargo Forum noted that some people were so elated over the success of the show, they wanted to make Gilbreth governor. The paper said of the idea, he certainly would be a booster and advertiser. But Gilbreth was immediately pulled into another project, working on an exhibit that was to highlight the northwestern United States. This governor's special was a train consisting of 9 cars, all equipped with electric lights and the latest and finest equipment. The trains would take 2 different routes, going from St. Paul to New York and back again. Governors, including North Dakota's John Burke, would be on board, speaking at stops along the way. Many commercial clubs around the state contributed to North Dakota's role in the project. According to reports, the train exhibit was well worth it. The Bismarck Tribune stated, Governor Burke may well feel proud of the exhibit, for in quality and artistic arrangement, it cannot be excelled. It has taken a lot of hard work to build up an exhibit worthy to be placed alongside those of the irrigated country of Idaho, Washington, and Oregon. But the labor has not been in vain, and the samples of grain, grasses, and other farm products are now packed and ready for shipment. North Dakota's exhibit was displayed in the same car as South Dakota and Minnesota. In addition to preparing this governor's special in time for departure on November 27th, Gilbreth also prepared a magnificent exhibit for the Northwest Land and Products Show, which opened in St. Paul on December 12th. Gilbreth never became governor, but he spent 11 years as agriculture commissioner, and his endeavors to spread knowledge about the state did not fail to impress. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Sarah Walker. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
That's it for this Wednesday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, it's Thanksgiving. Main Street Eats Sue Balcom joins Director of Radio Bill Thomas and me for a discussion of holiday do's and don'ts, at least from our perspective. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.